Hi there. You're listening to WGXE 90.7 FM in Acre, Hudson, Catskill, Columbia, and Greene Counties, New York State. This is the Art of the Hudson Valley. I'm your host, Chad Weckler, and today our guest is Brian Henry. Brian, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
I've known Brian for a while, and it's very easy to talk to him, and we're going to have an interesting hour program talking about the life of Brian. It's varied, and one of the things that I was attracted to is Brian's doodle of the day, which, you know, Brian, good for you for sharing what could be an insecurity of you're going through the process in a way of learning to draw, and you call it a doodle, but it is art, and you work very hard at it, and I know, having talked to you before, you're a musician, you've done stained glass, and I'm sure there's some other art forms that you've done too.
Yeah, I studied Stanislavski in the 70s. I was off Broadway in New York City for a couple of years, and that is a skill that has translated very well, transferred over into almost every other aspect of my life. I'm kind of like a local George Plimpton in a way, for those of us who are old enough to know who George Plimpton is.
Oh, yes.
I've done a lot of different things. Where do I start? Do you want to go chronologically?
Yeah, let's start.
Backwards or forwards? I mean, you know, there's a
lot of stuff. Let's start from the beginning in a sense. Are you a native New Yorker?
Yes, my parents were naturalized people from Jamaica, West Indies. They met in New York, and I was born here in New York, but I spent my formative years in Jamaica, Brownstown, St. Anne's Parish, Mon. And that has definitely had an impact on who I've become over my lifetime. So that's definitely been an influence in my life.
And what was your, when you got out of, say, high school and college, what did you want to do with your life?
When I graduated from high school, I just wanted to survive. Being an African American with just a high school education, my prospects for employment were relatively limited. So I ended up working as a security guard for a while in a nursing home, and then I ended up working in a nursing home, a couple of nursing homes, as an orderly for several years. From there, and then when I couldn't take it anymore, not that it was a bad job, I enjoyed taking care of people. They were like, I was like a surrogate family member to a lot of the people that were in my care. However, that's not what I wanted to do with my entire life. So from the nursing home, I ended up becoming a bill collector.
I worked. There's a change.
Yeah, it was a big mood swing, I should say. I did that for about a year, and I was winning awards, and I had all kinds of adventures going out to different neighborhoods to collect money from people. And I quit after one of the cases for collection that I had. Instead of getting a check, I got a police report. I cross-referenced the time of death on the police report with the last conversation I had with that individual, and it turned out I was the last person he ever spoke to. Mm. And after he promised to send the money, he shot himself in the head with a shotgun. And that's when I decided that I'd rather go into another line of work. Again, my options were somewhat limited, so I ended up driving a cab for a while. I remember towards the end of my cab driving experience, I remember the night that John Lennon got shot. And I was in the vicinity of the Dakota. Mm. And I saw people gathering outside the building to pay their respects to John Lennon. I could do hours on the kinds of people that I ended up engaging with as a cab driver in New York City, especially at night. One of the people in my cab turned out to know someone who worked in Bellevue Hospital. and said that they were looking for people to work as registrars in the emergency room. And I figured, okay, it's a steady job. It's not as dangerous as driving a cab was back at that moment in time. So I took the job. So I ended up working as a registrar in Bellevue's emergency room, walk-in emergency, and I became almost bilingual. I ended up learning a lot of Spanish because a lot of the people who came to walk-in emergency Bellevue spoke only Spanish, and we had to register them. So I ended up learning Spanish.
This is the early 1980s.
Yes, this was early 1980s. But while I was working in the emergency room, I became aware of openings for EMTs. And so I ended up taking all the courses. I became an EMT and started working as an EMT. And then while I was working as an EMT out of Bellevue, I realized that EMT was just the one aspect of emergency services. There were advanced life support providers, also known as paramedics. And so I went and I took that course. And I subsequently became a paramedic. During my tenure with Health and Hospitals working out of Bellevue, I came in contact with a lot of law enforcement personnel. And that's when I became interested in law enforcement. And so I made friends with people. Grand Central in particular was part of my primary area of response, or PAR as they used to call it back then. I don't know what they call it now. And I made friends with Captain Dorothy Schultz. She's no longer a captain there, but she was at the time. And I was having an argument with my paramedic partner over something that was unrelated to the treatment and transportation of what they call in police language ADIDs. And I jokingly said, you know what? I'm going to quit this job. I'm going to fill out an application for the police department. And the captain overheard me and handed me an application. And the next thing I know, I was an MTA. Back then, it was Metro North. I became a Metro North police officer, and I moved up through the ranks. I became a captain. I was a captain for over 10 years. And subsequently, after 9/11, I was living at ground zero during 9/11 and rendered aid to a lot of the people. I came, that was my day off. I heard the explosion. I thought it was a car accident on the West Side Highway. I looked out of the window. I was living at 380 Rector Place, and I saw smoke and flame and people jumping. After the collapse of the towers, I wrapped a wet towel around my face and went out and tried to help out with the rescue efforts. I had an unmarked police car that I was allowed to take home at the time as a captain, and it had gotten hit by falling debris. And I subsequently drove to my command in Midtown, and I was still trailing dust at that point. I subsequently was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress syndrome, of which I think I've recovered. I subsequently retired as a lieutenant. Many of us at that time had reduced ourselves in rank so as to collect overtime so that we could improve our pension. As management, we couldn't work overtime, so the overtime came in handy because it was pensionable, which kind of contributed to my retirement fund in the long run. I subsequently retired. During all of this, I moved from place to place and ended up in Hyde Park, New York, in Dutchess County, where I still reside now. And I made lots of new friends, you included.
Yeah.
And one of my friends had a woodworking shop, and he invited me to come in and work on projects with him, except he liked to brainstorm a lot. So his brainstorming caused me to go out and get a sketchbook because that was the only way I could keep up with him. And it was in the course of sketching all of his ideas that were coming up intermittently during any given project that I realized that I might be able to draw. And so I went out and bought a bunch of art supplies and played mad scientist with all these art supplies. And now I actually have art on display in various locations and had ended up selling a couple of them. I post them on Facebook almost daily.
Yes.
I call them doodle of the moment. And for the life of me, people seem to really like my doodles. So I have a little bit of a following in terms of social media with the drawings. And I think one of the things that people are most fascinated about my drawings is that And I'm just as fascinated myself. Sometimes I'll do a doodle and go, did I do that? You know, we can see the progression from when I first started posting these doodles to the level that I'm at now. And it's blowing my mind, and people seem to enjoy it. So it's something that I do.
Well, I think seeing the process and sharing what you're sharing is a gift to, you know, it's like, oh, Brian is sharing what he's doing right now, his doodle.
Yeah, it's kind of like having my own strange social media reality show or something.
Yeah.
You know, which I enjoy sharing with people because, you know, living where I live, you're surrounded by nature. And I love nature. I love being outdoors. And where my house is situated, it's surrounded by woods. And so there's a lot of natural things that I can fixate on and try to draw. Although the last several months I've been trying to draw portraitures. And the initial ones, compared to the ones that I'm drawing now, were very crude. I have no formal training in art, which is one of the reasons I call them doodles. I used to go to the museum when I lived in the city. I used to go to the Metropolitan Museum of Art a lot. And besides Arm and Armor and the Egyptian exhibit, I also used to look at a lot of religious art and Renaissance art. And so hopefully one day I'll be able to create art or doodles on that level of quality. But right now, it's kind of what it is. And I'm enjoying it. For me, it's a form of meditation. I do it because I enjoy it, not so much because I want to become the next whatever. And I've been pleasantly surprised. People kind of like my doodles. So I'm not going to resist that. But my main motivation for creating them is because it makes me feel good, especially when I draw something that I think looks kind of nice.
Well, maybe that's been part of your therapy when you mentioned PSD, post-traumatic stress syndrome. And maybe this is part of that therapy, because it sounds like the years that you put in as a paramedic and a police officer can be very in your face with a lot of humanity.
Well, yeah, it was in my face with a lot of humanity. I dealt with other transportation workers. I dealt with the commuters, which was like a tidal community that came in and out of the city. And I also dealt with the homeless population, and I became the community services officer. I was a one-man unit when I first started, then I had a partner for many years.
And there was nothing like that before?
No, not in this department. No, I was the first one. And I got a lot of media attention for the efforts and some of the outcomes that I had with doing homeless outreach in the tunnels underneath Grand Central Terminal. And then I ended up becoming, how should I say, a subject of a lot of media attention. Back in 1991, I ended up on the cover of the Metro section of the New York Times. The article is still online. Sergeant Henry coaxing Grand Central's homeless into the light was the headline of the article. And that opened up a floodgate of media and other forms of attention that was quite an adventure for me. I got to meet Mrs. Astor. She read the initial article and wanted to have an audience with me. It was like going to see the Queen. And she ended up donating a certain amount of funds to various homeless organizations in Manhattan as a result of our meeting. I had another partner. Her name was Sherry Siegel. She was a nurse. I haven't seen her talk to her in ages, but we were partners with dealing with creating very specific case management for homeless people. We believe that one size didn't fit all. So it was very labor intensive and it was very slow, but it was very effective. And it culminating in the creation of an initiative that included the federal government, HUD, New York State, and New York City. It was called the New York, New York Initiative. And we also had initiated a program called Enforced Engagement, where you had an interdisciplinary team of law enforcement and social service providers and other caregivers that would pool their resources to help humanely relocate a lot of the clients from the streets and the tunnels to back to their lives or halfway housing or some form of housing other than shelters. And it was a very successful initiative. And we were able to house a lot of people who otherwise might have ended up like a lot of other clients. They all didn't make it. A lot of people died in abandoned buildings and abandoned vehicles and in open spaces that would freeze to death. And so there was a sad side to the whole thing. We ended up teaming up with people who had access to the church, the Catholic Church on 42nd and 8th. And we did a couple of services for some of the quote-unquote clients that had passed away that we were trying to take care of. And we used the chapel at Bellevue on a couple of occasions to do the same thing. So it got a lot of media attention, a lot of documentaries, videos, BBC, French, Japanese, Univision, Chinese, to name a few articles in Time Out magazine, Der Spiegel. Because I was a Buddhist, I was a Buddhist since 1976, Triangle magazine did an article with me about my motivation based on Buddhism to try to be a bodhisattva and take care of, have compassion for people who might otherwise perish. I'm on my umpteenth edition of attempting to cram all of that into a book.
Oh, good.
So it's been an interesting, my life has been, I've had an interesting life on a lot of levels, and that's just half of it. I also was a musician before I was in law enforcement. I stopped while I was in law enforcement, and now I'm getting back into playing out and so on and so forth. I'm a percussionist. I'm not professional. I was also self-taught, but people had actually paid me to play in the past, so I guess you could say I was professional from that context. But now most of my playing is at the Woodstock Drum Circle on Sundays in the community center during the winter from 4 to 7. We get together. It's kind of like a party. It's half gig, half party, half performance art, and it's a lot of fun. And then in the summertime, the timekeeper, Kevin Johnson, he basically runs the drum circle, and we meet at the Village Green in Woodstock, and we have a lot of fun playing, and people come and dance, and it's like a little party, and it's a lot of fun. And that too is also therapeutic, not just for me, but for a lot of people.
Well, this is WGXC 90.7 FM, and this is the Art of the Hudson Valley. I'm your host, Chad Weckler, and we're talking to Brian Henry. We're kind of bouncing back and forth with his history of here and there, and we're going to continue talking to Brian, and he was just speaking about the drum circle. I did that once with you, just, you know, in a small...
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Small, it was only, I think, three of us, and you shared some of your drums, and it's a very... how would you describe a drum circle experience?
Okay, if you have people who are intermediate to advanced drummers or people who have natural rhythm, because there are people who don't have rhythm, but they can learn rhythm, but if they're not able to keep time as precisely as needed, then it doesn't have the same effect. But if you do have people who can keep time, even if they're not professional percussionists, what happens is what I describe as a form of communion. Scientists have discovered that rhythms, especially by the people who are playing the rhythms, have been known to go into a semi or full trance state, also known as cerebral entrainment, where both hemispheres of your brain become synchronized, and it enhances the experience, and it's kind of like meditation, and it can be somewhat transcendental, depending on how long you play, how well you play, and what your susceptibility is to, entering that state of mind. So that is the spirituality aspect of it from a pseudo or maybe scientific perspective. So for me personally, it's a form of communion. I like to say that rhythm is my bliss. I went to a New Year's party this year, and there was a guitarist there, and he's a professional, accomplished guitarist. And they know that I like to play, and we've played a few times together. I also play on traps, you know, regular drums with cymbals and snares and what have you, and bass drum and all that. And so I was familiar with his style of playing. But, of course, I didn't have my drum set, and I didn't know he was going to be at the event. So I improvised using a pot, and I stuffed my jacket into the pot to get the desired effect, acoustic effect from the pot. And we ended up playing until, like, 4:30 in the morning.
Wow.
Because we had gotten into such a nice groove together, and we played everything from blues to all kinds of improvisational, esoteric stuff, but it was still rhythmic. Mm. And it was a lot of fun. So that's the kind of experience that I've had playing, you know, with just with friends or just locally. I was backing up another friend, Poet Gold. She was a poet laureate for Dutchess County for the last couple of years. And we'd team up and we'd play out at schools on a couple of occasions, or we'd do an event at Vassar College. And for about a year and a half, we were regular acts during the week downstairs, the underground at the Falcon. Tony Falco and I ended up making friends, and it's a nice venue. Mm-hmm. It's not too big, not too small. And so we would do a lot of performance art with spoken word and percussion at the Falcon. I haven't done that in a while. I kind of stopped doing it. It's possible that I may get back into that, but it was a nice experience hanging out with Poet Gold. So those are some of the experiences that I've had just as a musician playing in certain venues around the Hudson Valley just for fun. And so
as you are working full time for the police department, at some point was music a hobby, or did it obviously it came natural, I'm assuming.
It took a lot of conscious effort to develop, you know, certain percussion techniques or whatever. Before I was in law enforcement, I played in various bands back in the 70s. We played a lot of venues. I don't know if anybody in the audience will know of these venues in the city. There was the Electric Circus and SOBs and CBGBs, to name a few. We played a lot of dive bars.
Kansas City?
I don't remember playing in Kansas City. I may have, but I don't remember every venue that I ever played in. You know, we were on the road a little bit. I remember playing in a prison in New Jersey. We did a gig. It was an overnight gig. We had a pillow fight with prison pillows, which felt like cinder blocks, but that's a whole nother conversation. So, yeah, you know, it was fun playing out. Like I said, I got paid to do that.
Yeah.
And then when I couldn't survive off of the money that I made doing that type of gigging, you know, I never became a full-fledged rock star or anything like that, obviously. But it was a lot of fun. It was an interesting experience. And then there was the off-Broadway stuff, the acting. I worked with Bert Brinkerhoff. I don't know if anybody knows who that is. David Papp, Joe Papp,
yeah.
I auditioned for him, ended up getting a couple of parts with him over a period of time. And studying Stanislavski, like I said, came in handy in so many ways. I mean, I used a lot of the acting methodology that I learned when I was a police captain. So, you know, command presence and things of that nature. You had no idea what the hell was going on. Nobody knew what was going on. It was chaos, but you still acted like you knew what you were doing. If you were convincing enough, people would kind of fall into line and you'd be able to kind of get things to have the outcome that the desirable outcome, you know, with the least amount of suffering or pain to the public and the least cost to the people who were footing the bill. But that's all another conversation.
Well, you know, I arrived in New York City in 1976 and from California, and I found New York City bustling, alive, dirty, loud, dangerous, fun. And I certainly remember the homeless situation was, especially in the late 70s, early 80s, it was dire. it was, and there were a lot of dangerous places where you didn't go, and now that's kind of all changed. But I wonder, I mean, when you were in Grand Central, that I assume just going down in the tunnels was a dangerous job.
Yes, which is why I would, one, go by myself, and even though there were radio dead spots and all with the possibility of some type of danger, there were a lot of, as we like to say in social work speak, clients who were psychologically challenged. And going down like gangbusters would often trigger a lot of the behaviors from them that you don't want. Going down by myself, I can go quietly. I can move at a pace that was comfortable for me. I could hear. It was very quiet, especially in the more isolated areas. It's very quiet, especially in the more isolated areas of the subterranean infrastructure underneath Grand Central Terminal. And so you could hear somebody in the distance rustling around in the cardboard and the newspapers and the boxes and whatever. You could even hear the rats moving around from a safe distance because it's so quiet in some
places.
Was it
territorial for the clients? In the sense that, you know, they had their box, their corner, their little nook.
It varied from client to client because each client had their own experience of what it was like to be down there. Some were highly functional and just needed a safe and quiet place to seek shelter. Others were completely a threat to themselves and other people because of the mental state that they were in. And so you would approach everybody based on who you perceive them to be at the initial moment of contact, which I would do from maybe several yards away in case, you know, they would. It had never happened in that context where someone would. I've been attacked. But usually during the initial contact, I would be in just an overall. I didn't have a lot of shiny objects hanging off of me, like, you know, my police badge or whatever. So they weren't sure who I was. As far as they knew, I might have been another homeless person. And I would talk to them from a distance and, hey, how you doing? Are you okay? Are you hungry? I have a couple. And I would carry snacks with me as an engagement tool for the outreach. And they say, here, here's a granola bar or whatever. And I would use that as an engagement tool. A lot of the clients would open up to me. I mean, if you demonstrated genuine concern and treated them with genuine respect, I would say 99% of the time they would respond in kind. There were times when someone was so psychologically impaired that they'd lunge at you, they'd come at you. But fortunately, when I was about 12, my parents sent me to a dojo, a martial arts school. And I ended up, this is long before I got into law enforcement, I ended up being an assistant instructor, and I used to go to tournaments and stuff like that. So that skill set helped me, one, it gave me the confidence that I needed to engage people who might otherwise be dangerous. And they can sense if you're afraid of them or not, in many cases, not always. And because I was easygoing and I presented myself as non-threateningly as possible, most of the time, even people who might have had a predisposed to violence, and I can tell you a story about that, would be open. They'd be receptive to any suggestions that I might have about them talking to a regular social worker or getting access to a particular social program that they could be, that they might benefit from. And subsequently, on a couple of occasions when people did take a swing at me or punch at me, I was able to minimize the...
Diffuse the situation
yeah. without hurting them seriously. Although I did carry a riot stick with me because down in the tunnels, you find yourself in very close quarters, confined spaces. And the last thing you want to do is shoot somebody down there.
Yeah.
Because the radio, they can't hear you on the radio. If they're still alive after you bust a cap in somebody, you know, my inclination would be to try to render first aid. And if they can't hear you, to send help. And even if they could hear you, the way it's, There's no markers. Recently, they put up in certain areas street signs, you know, street numbers for the emergency exits, so you'd have an idea of where you were. But when I first started going down there and the places that I went, there was no physical thing for you to have a reference point so that somebody who'd never been down there would be able to find you. As a matter of fact, when I first started going down there, it was the homeless people that I encountered, that I befriended, who showed me around.
Mm.
And so I became a mole person, so to speak, which is the name of a book by Jennifer Toth that came out around that time, which wasn't very accurate, but it did bring public attention to the plight of some of the people that were called mole people.
So what was your intent to negotiate maybe a alternate lifestyle where you could coax them out of the tunnels and into possibly rehabilitation or a safer place to live? Or would you actually allow certain individuals, as long as they were safe, to continue living there?
No, it's an unsafe environment. There's a lot of chemical waste, carcinogens, asbestos, so a lot of that's been cleaned up now. I seem to be, knock on wood, I seem to have been impervious to a lot of that stuff so far. No, that's not a place for a human being to live. And so, again, each individual was different. Sometimes it would take a couple of chicken dinners to coax them out. I had an arrangement with a clothing drop at St. Agnes Church, which was on 44th Street off of Madison Avenue. And, you know, we bent a couple of the rules, but during cold weather, I would get coats and stuff for people, and blankets and stuff for people, and I would use those as engagement tools. And, you know, once you established a rapport, it was a lot easier to convince someone that they needed to take better care of themselves and that they didn't deserve to live the way that they were living, you know, in self-exile or whatever because of whatever. And so I was kind of like a social worker with a gun and a badge. One of the things that happened to me that has stayed with me over the years is that there was a woman who had a toddler, and she was using the toddler. She was not a drug addict or an alcoholic or a prostitute or anything like that. And she was using her toddler as a prop to panhandle for money. And there was a wannabe politician, who I will not name, who was with a small entourage going through the terminal and who had seen this woman with her child begging for money. And because of their status, felt that they were empowered to order me to lock her up and take her kid from her and put the kid as a ward of the state. And I knew that the kid wasn't really in danger, that this particular woman was really hard-pressed, and this is the only way that she could get money. She wasn't on drugs. They had given me a hole in the wall in what was now the Gray Bar passageway. There was no furniture, no phone, no nothing. I got furniture from the drop-in center. They sent in some old furniture, and I found a telephone jack that was still alive, and I commandeered a phone from headquarters. And the reason I got my own office was because they didn't like the smell of the clients that I would bring into the office to process them, so they gave me my own hole in the wall. The first guy that I had was a volunteer. He was a civilian, and he was homeless, but he was in the drop-in center over at St. Agnes. And they sent him over to help me out. And so he was showing me around the tunnels, and then one day he disappeared. I subsequently found out that he'd been incarcerated for homicide. He was on a food line, and somebody had jumped in front of him, and he stabbed the guy to death. Meanwhile, I'm down in the tunnels by myself with this guy, you know? So that was one instance of where...
So he had a short fuse, you might say, or...
In that particular situation, yeah. So that was a wake-up call for me, because they didn't vet the people that were coming to help me out. And so I didn't know that they didn't vet these people, you know. And so I had been rubbing elbows with a lot of people who might otherwise be, how should I say, predisposed to robbing under different set of circumstances, which did almost happen while I was in full uniform at rush hour on the main concourse. There was an individual, his name was Black. I don't know if he's alive or dead now. This was years ago. And he came up to me and tried to rob me while I was in full uniform with my utility belt on. Yeah. I was armed the whole nine yards. And I just took a step back and I said, Black, look at me. Think about what you're doing. This is not a good idea. This is not going to, the outcome is not. And just that moment of hesitation, and he came to his senses and apologized. He said, I'm sorry. Hmm. You know, I just wanted to get a bottle. And we never spoke of it again. I could have locked him up, but I didn't. Fortunately, there were times where I could not communicate with my command via radio or phone. So I ended up having to recruit, or they recruited me. I guess it was mutual. And we had a little collective called the Bowery Boys. And they watched my back. And I would never give them money, but I would buy them meals and get them clothes and try to get them jobs down at the fish market down at South Street Seaport when they were still hiring people at 3 and 4 in the morning to load boxes or whatever. And some of the vendors back then were predisposed, vendors in the terminal. To hiring people off the books. And if I had a client that, or a person, homeless person, who I thought could benefit from that kind of a break, and some did, I would get them jobs. So we kind of took care of each other in that context. And if somebody, if there was a new jack, so to speak, that came into the to our territory, they wouldn't tell other people about it, but they'd come to me and tell me about it. If they felt that another officer might be a little bit too aggressive, they'd come and tell me about it, and I'd try to have, you know, have a word with the officer and just say, you know, just be careful. You know, they didn't go to the internal affairs, they came to me, and I'm just letting you know that you need to be a little more gentle on some, with some of these guys. And it worked out. On other occasions, you would find a homeless couple in an isolated area, like on Valentine's. It's a true story. It was Valentine's Day. And there was a couple consummating their relationship in an isolated area. And they were surprised to see me. And as you know, Cornelius Vanderbilt was the founder of the railroad. And I said, what are you going to do, name the baby Cornelius? I thought it was funny. Yes. They had no idea who I was talking about. And they went, can we finish? Anyway, those are the kind of anecdotal stories. I have hundreds of stories like that. Of different things. So anyway, this woman with the baby that they tried to have me remove from the mother, I was able to help her out, and she showed up almost 20 years to the day. I didn't recognize her, and she had her son with her, who was a couple inches taller than me, and I'm 6'2". That was the baby.
Wow.
She was the mother, and she came back after 19, 20 years to thank me for keeping her family together. And for me, that was like a sign from whatever, from whomever, yeah. that, you know, I had done something good, and that that was my way of finding out that something good came of all of this.
It's so quite possible you've never, 20 years later, had that closure, and thankfully you did, to sort of...
Well, in that case, that was one case, but there were others. When I was dating my wife, Angela... we were living in the city at the time, and it didn't matter where I went in the city, whether it was Central Park, whether it was Battery Park City, or someplace on the Upper West Side, a client would show up, and they'd recognize me. And back then, my street name, even though I had moved up through the ranks, was Sarge, because that's when they met me. I was a sergeant at the time. And they go, hey, Sarge! And I turn around, and okay, here's a dollar, watch my car. Good to see you, you're looking good. And of course, my date was very impressed because they come out and start a conversation. Yeah, you know, he helped me out. He saved me, told me to take better care of myself, and now I'm back with my family, or whatever the their case was. In those cases where they're back with their family and working, I wouldn't give them a dollar to watch the car, obviously. But it was a poignant moment nonetheless. I remember there was one guy. He was notorious. He gave me such a hard time. And he was one of the few that I would have to put into the system because they just would not listen to reason. They would not respond to any kind of help. They would refuse whatever. And this guy was a crackhead. We locked him up multiple times. Finally accepted help. Years went by. Went into a lobby of a building down in Wall Street area. And there he was with a suit and tie on, working security and gave me a big hug and told me thanks for the help. And now he goes to church regularly, and he's married and has two kids. And that kind of scenario did repeat itself for a while. And so when that moment happened, it was always a good moment. It was always fun.
So this is WGXC 90.7 FM in Acre, Hudson, Catskill, Green, and Columbia counties. This is the Art of the Hudson Valley. I'm your host, Chad Weckler, and we're talking with Brian Henry. And Brian, I want to sort of bring us up to the present using that past experience, because you are a very, my opinion, a very zenful individual. And you know, going back to Facebook, which, you know, a lot of us use that as a social platform. You use it for multiple things. Love the cat videos. Who doesn't? Who doesn't love the cat videos? The doodles that you do almost on a daily basis. And then, you know, the humanity, you know, what's going on in the world. And I think you bring a lot of your perspective of humanity and, you know, why can't we all get along? And that crosses into, you know, the social and also the political, and but mostly the social aspect of why can't we all get along and why can't we share some common sense and maybe I can help you, you can help me kind of thing. I enjoy your perspective because I know your history, and our listeners are also getting to know you from your history. What inspires you? What makes you want to speak out and talk about these things?
Well, going back to when I first graduated from high school, you know, and this was years before I went back to college and subsequently graduated. I went to Fordham University in Manhattan. Lincoln Center, which is a Jesuit school, and that helped to inform my perspective. But generally speaking, when I first graduated from high school, and I became aware of the divide in terms of access to housing, opportunity, and education for members of what I like to call disfavored social groups, I experienced that firsthand. And it was not the best experience for somebody that age to have, coming of age, to realize that your options are limited because of residual effects of chattel slavery or disenfranchisement of disfavored social groups, or however you want to package it. I was part of that. So I was part of that demographic, you know, the young male black, seen as a perennial opportunistic predator, et cetera, et cetera, although that was not my personality profile. But that kind of perception on the part of the dominant culture was something that I had to deal with. And as I worked my way up the socioeconomic food chain from scratch, I realized that maybe I could try to motivate other people to take more of an initiative to either help other people or to help themselves or both. And so that's kind of the kernel of my perspective.
And even now, I mean, certainly at home, Cheryl and I, we talk a lot about what we see on the news, and just, it's really changed, I think, in this new administration, where people are talking a lot more about their point of view and their beliefs, and which I find, especially through social media, that sharing opportunity where you actually, I can learn something, which, you know, and sometimes Cheryl will say, you should probably just delete what you just said, because maybe I was just a little too upfront and too comical or too serious. But I find it healthy to talk about these issues, and inequality is a big one for me. It's bigotry. I just and I have this with family members and friends, especially on social media, where I just have to say, are you kidding? And, you know, I give my point of view because, you know, it's just like sitting at the dining room table conversing, because I have one particular cousin. I need to bring her around to some truth. It's, you know, not necessarily my point of view, but when they get into this, I would call it fake news sort of vein, I have to say, Pam, that's fake. And here's the link. And God bless you. And she hasn't deleted me yet. So we have a healthy relationship in that regard. And
I have friends that have differing political and social views than mine, but we're friends. We enjoy each other's company. Mm. In some cases, we've even gone on vacations together. We went to Canada on a couple of occasions, and when we were passing through the border, the border agent saw them, who happened to be of European descent, and they saw me sitting in the back and wanted to know how we knew each other.
Hmm.
And we'd have fun with that. And we enjoy each other's company in that context, but on social media, it was a totally different dynamic. And it wasn't just this one set of friends. There are a lot of different friends who have different opinions about, you know, have a different worldview. And even though we're friends, for whatever reason, and we enjoy that friendship, we sometimes unfriend each other on Facebook.
Hmm.
And still get together on the side, or we just don't talk politics. And that's a unique situation. For me, I decided when I first got involved with social media that I was not going to allow trolls or people who had differing worldviews to dictate what I thought or what I should express on social media, because that's who I am. This is the perspective I have. And I had a similar experience. I wrote for a local newspaper. I won't say which one it was, but I don't write for them anymore. But I will say what the name of the column was, in case anybody out there has read it in the past. And I did have a little bit of a following. It was called Another Perspective. And we talk about people like Tiger Woods and what happened, you know, to the demise of his marriage. Or we talk about Michael Jackson and why he started out looking like a black man and ended up looking more like a white woman, with all due respect, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And talk about the underlying causes and dynamics of those kinds of things in the article that I wrote, in the column that I wrote. I do kind of the same thing on social media, but a lot of the people who don't agree with my perspective say, oh, you write too much, it's too long, I don't have time to read all of that, and then they would just go back to their default position.
Mm.
But yet we're still friends. And then there are others, on the other hand, you know, a lot of the trolls and stuff like that, I just dispose of them. I block them or unfriend them or whatever, because there's no arguing with them. There's no reasoning with them. I've been fortunate that a lot of the people who have taken the time to try to look at things through my lens, they understand and they get the idea. And I'm not looking for, as a minority, I'm not looking for special treatment. I'm not looking for, you know, special dispensation. What I hope I would get would be empathy and understanding, which I have gotten. And to me, that's priceless.
I consider you almost like the great negotiator. It's like decades that you've been doing that, you know, informing, helping. And I always love a good conversation, because conversation doesn't always have to be agreeable. And when someone comes up with an opposing view, I'm all ears. Because I want to see, have I made a mistake somewhere along the line, in the sense of drawing conclusions? Because I like to keep an open, at least I think I like to keep an open mind about me changing. I don't want to be stuck in the mud.
Well, for me, from my perspective, it's very interesting how a lot of times when we get into a good debate, and I love to debate, when we get into a good debate, we're often debating about the same reality, just a different way of looking at the same reality. And so that's where I have the most fun, because I can keep going back to my perspective on that same reality and find points where they intersect and kind of use that to come to some type of common perspective, even if it's only about something that's very granular. It doesn't always work. I've learned a lot from trolls in terms of, how to get under their skin, because their agenda is to get under everybody else's skin. But I've enjoyed learning how to turn the tables on a lot of the trolls, and so I have fun with that. And there are times when I tease some of the people who have trollish tendencies by saying, you know, they call me the troll killer, the troll hunter, not killer, hunter,
yeah.
The troll hunter, and they I'll stop there. Sometimes I do things that are irrational or illogical. I'll say things that are illogical for effect, not because I believe them to be true, but because I know that if I do speak truth to a troll or to somebody with a different point of view, that they're not going to believe it, no matter how I sugarcoat it or what type of diplomatic vernacular I use. They're just not going to buy it. And so then I will start using some of their tactics on them just for fun. I shouldn't really do that because it can come back to bite you in terms of diminishing your credibility. But
I don't believe that. Don't believe that. And you know, bringing that back to your doodles.
Yeah.
And what you said earlier about having, you know, gone to the Met and looked at some of the religious paintings and wanted, it sounds like you would like to be there as an artist where you've continued your doodles and they have gotten, do you want them to get closer to that kind of art?
Sometimes. And sometimes I just feel like drawing some clouds and a landscape, and I'm getting better at that, and people seem to like the ones that I do, especially when I do them in color, which I haven't been doing a lot of lately. But the ones that I have done, I've gotten an amazing response to them, and I've actually sold some of them. But
and you're still part of the gallery at Rhinebeck?
Yeah, I'm going to be there indefinitely.
Good.
So we'll see what happens.
It's great. You know, that's a great opportunity because a lot of artists don't have or never taken that opportunity to show work and to get feedback. You're getting feedback from social media, but you know, a gallery situation I think is totally different, and the feedback when you sell something, that's a whole new experience I think for an artist.
Yeah, for me it was definitely a new experience, especially since I've just been doing this for only a couple of years. I'm attached to each doodle or each piece of art that I create. And so it was very difficult for me to let go of the originals, which is why right now I'm only selling prints.
Yeah.
But I'm getting to the point now where I could let go of original stuff that I have archived in the house. And my house is turning into a fire hazard as it is with all these pieces piling up. But
that's the natural life of an artist, by the way, is having a lot of artwork backed up, sitting in the house, and that's the way. That's the way we live.
Yeah,
we can't sell everything.
Well, I'm blessed that I paid my dues. I had my career. I'm reaping the benefits. I have a comfortable existence with my pension and so on. And it's nice that a lot of the people who disagree with my worldview, they don't sign my pension check. So it's kind of liberating in that context. Well, the same thing is for art. I'm glad that I don't have to sell art in order to survive. Mm. And that's a luxury, and I don't take it lightly. I'm just now beginning to maybe think of myself as an artist. Because I know enough to know that there's a lot that I don't know. Mm-hmm. I know enough to know that there's a lot that I can't do that I would love to be able to do, but I keep trying to sneak up on it nonetheless, you know, when I do my doodles. I'm just happy that I can do the art and not worry about having to sell something in order to pay the rent. And so that, to me, is like nirvana.
Well, you could rest on your doodles. In the sense that, you know, it is art. You know, you're on your way. You're in the journey, and you know, every piece that you create is a part of you and part of your learning experience. And You're putting it out there. You're not hiding it. And, you know, I think that's a good thing.
It is a good thing. And this journey, what really keeps me motivated in this journey is the rate of progress that I seem to be making with my doodles. And it's just why I post all of them, because if you go back to the early ones, you can see how bad they really were. And how much, you know, the progress that I'm making. And sometimes it's like a quantum leap, you know, where I go from like a kid with a crayon to somebody who might be mistaken for an artist. And I that to me is the hardest part, is that it's like I just jumped into a pool of cold water and I'm just now beginning to get used to the temperature. That's what it feels like every time I draw something and I realize that I've made like this really amazing leap from one process to another that should have taken me much longer to do. And that freaks me out. But it doesn't stop me from playing mad scientist and spending money at art stores buying all kinds of art supplies.
Well, artists are always practicing. They're always... A friend of mine posted on Facebook about photography. He said, you know, do not create the same photograph. And, you know, a lot of us were like, well, what's wrong with that? And I understand you, and I think that's good. So there was, it was interesting that, you know, he got both sides of the story from very accomplished photographers saying, I agree and I disagree. And that's just the point of view from the creator, those that, you know, we create. So, you know, we're always, I like to think that I should not, I should open my eyes and ears a little bit more and look at an image and say, oh, go ahead. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't look perfect, but maybe you'll like it later.
I can identify with that. Sometimes I have something that I started and I get ready to throw it away and Angel will say, no, don't throw it away. And then 2 days later, I'll go back and I'll see something I didn't see before. And then I'll work on it. And then it turns out to be something that people really like and that I've sold a couple of them. So who knows?
Does Angela give you assistance in her opinion?
No, she kind of hesitates to do that. And it's okay, because I'm not drawing to please her. Mm. I'm just drawing because I enjoy it. So having said that, it's been a pleasant nuisance for me to now go back and look at art that I admired in the past or new art that I like that's done by really super accomplished artists that do things that I hope to do, you know, at some point in the not-too-distant future. And the pleasant nuisance of that is that I don't look at the world through the same lens that I looked at the world through before I started doing art.
Perfect.
Doodles.
Yeah.
You know, I'm constantly looking at values, because I've learned this new vernacular, this whole new vocabulary that artists use, you know, values, you know, and contour and this and that and the other. And so I'm starting to see that, and I'm starting to pay attention to those kinds of details in the real world. And just how granular it can get. And the more granular I get with the details, the more interesting the doodles become.
So, Brian, you will continue doing your doodles, and you'll continue your drum circles. And it sounds like you have a book or two that you want to create. So, you know, maybe next time we talk, you'll be an author.
Well, I have been an author. I've been published before for other things, you know, Transportation Security Magazine. I've written an article or two for them back in when I was, you know, doing my thing in law enforcement. I've been published, you know, with that local paper that I had a column with for a while. And there are a couple other things that I wrote that somehow ended up in places that I didn't expect them to end up in. But in terms of writing a fictional piece, because, you know, it's like that movie series, that TV series, The Naked City, the 8 Million Stories in The Naked City, this is one of them. But the names have been changed to Protect the Innocent. You know, there are a lot of anecdotal stories that I could tell that would be very poignant and very entertaining. But at the same time, I respect the privacy of certain homeless people or certain colleagues that I worked with. And I wouldn't want to write anything about them that would embarrass them or otherwise bring negative attention to them. But at the same time, These are some really interesting human interest stories.
Yeah.
So I have to walk the tightrope between creating fictional composites of characters that would still convey or express whatever that event or moment was.
Well, Brian, I want to thank you for being on the Art of the Hudson Valley. We have come to the conclusion of this month's podcast.
I need a ghostwriter.
Just putting it out there. This is WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Hudson, Catskill. This has been the Art of the Hudson Valley. I'm your host, Chad Weckler, and we've had an engaging hour with Brian Henry, and I hope our listeners enjoy Brian's story. Thank you, Brian.
You're very welcome.